Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and coach at the Couple Center and Couple Speak in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live alternate Wednesdays now at 8:30 p.m. It's getting earlier and earlier as we move forward to accommodate all you early risers. I actually began in the beginning of this over a year ago, starting at 11 p.m., so this is really early bird stuff. Anyway, tonight's episode, February 8th, 2012, is titled Effective Trauma Treatment and Its Impact on Relationships. My guest and co-host is Phil Harford, a psychotherapist well known for his effective work with clients who have survived early trauma and neglect and who have resulting attachment issues, anxiety, or depression. In his work, Phil combines talk therapy, skills coaching, EMDR, and clinical hypnosis and guided imagery. Phil is a certified hypnotherapist as well as a level 2 EMDR practitioner. After the show, you can contact him through his website, SeacoastPsychotherapy.com, or at his Portsmouth office at 603-766-0137. Before I bring Phil on the air, one brief technical issue. Your toll-free call-in number, for those of you who may have forgotten it or lost it, is 877-497-9046. All callers will be muted unless you have a question or a comment, in which case just press the 1 key on your phone to be in line to join us on the air. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Susan.
How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Good. We lucked out. We didn't have a snowstorm, so we didn't have that usual anxiety about whether a nor'easter would stop the broadcast. I've been through some of those.
Yes, we're all grateful for the unusual weather this time of year.
Yeah. Anyway, I was thinking, Phil, about holding off on questions for particular times or intervals in the show so we can cover everything we need to. We have a lot of content, and I'm wondering how what you think about that.
I think that makes sense. You know, there's a lot of content, so we can play it by ear and get through a certain amount of content and then hopefully have the opportunity to open up the lines if there are calls coming through. Yeah.
Okay, good. And I don't think we should wait to the very end because people may forget their question, but this way we'll have some flow going. Anyway, Phil, many people may not be familiar with EMDR. So I'm wondering if you could define it for our listeners, and if you could also say something about how you came to be an EMDR practitioner.
Sure. EMDR is an integrative therapy, mind-body therapy, that was developed initially for the treatment of psychological trauma. It stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, and, you know, it's a pretty odd name. The founder, Francine Shapiro, wanted to change it to reprocessing therapy, but too many people already knew it as EMDR, as some people know it as that strange eye movement therapy thing that we do. And in order to talk more about EMDR and how I came into it, let me just make a couple observations about psychological trauma and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, post-traumatic stress symptoms tell us something about not only the kind of trauma a person survived, but how they coped with it and survived it. And because post-traumatic symptoms are a continuation of a person's past response to the original traumatic experience, it becomes a problem of past creeping into the present. Mm-hmm. And so for example, somebody experiencing hypervigilance, experiencing that in the present, experience that initially in order to be prepared to protect oneself by anticipating danger and standing guard, or numbness and dissociation as a way of inwardly or psychically escaping an experience that one could not escape physically, or anger in order to mobilize the fight response and defend oneself, shame maybe to dampen the anger, when one becomes helpless against a threat, perhaps depression then as a buffer against the pain of ongoing helplessness. So all of these are experiences that are part of the trauma experience. And trauma can be a what Francine Shapiro, the founder of EMDR, refers to as a large T trauma, a significant traumatic event leading to post-traumatic stress disorder, or a small T trauma, a disturbing experience in the past that can affect us in our relationship patterns or lead to anxiety. And during the original experience of trauma, the mind and body responded instinctively and automatically to a threat. And any one of the five senses will send a signal to the brain and to the limbic system, especially the part of the brain, the emotional part of the brain. And that will activate the adrenaline response system, the fight or flight response, so that the heart rate will then increase, the respiratory system increase, so that we can get oxygen to the major muscle groups, putting us into that fight or flight state. And it's all about survival.
It's an adaptive response.
It's an adaptive response, exactly. But along with that, the thinking part of the brain, the frontal cortex, becomes inhibited. That's also adaptive because that happens to quicken our response to the threat. And the problem, again, is the past becomes the present. And so a person re-experiences all those arousal symptoms as well as the memory of the trauma now has been stored in such a way that's was mediated by that limbic system, that emotional part of the brain, not engaged with the thinking part of the brain. Mm-hmm. And so, and that includes the language center of the brain. And so it becomes difficult to talk about. And that creates a problem for us as therapists because we come to depend on our clients talking. So we have to use then a different approach and work with the body as well. PTSD is also then a problem of the information flow becoming blocked up. Mm-hmm. It's a condition where the normal integrative function of brain, mind, and body become blocked, where past experiences then they lose that normal time stamp, and they become re-experienced in the present moment as though they're reoccurring. Daniel Siegel is a neuropsychiatrist and a popular author. He defines it scientifically as a lack of integration of multiple neural networks. Neural networks being, the associations in the brain and of emotions and memory and experiences. A lack of integration of multiple neural networks of implicit and explicit memory. Implicit memory being the memory of experience and emotion and sensation, but without the context that front part of the brain gives.
Right.
The narrative, the language. So that's the challenge with trauma. And I was working, I think, in the late 90s in an outpatient clinic before I was trained in EMDR. Didn't know very much about it. Thought it was strange.
Well, it always sounds strange. Yeah, it always sounds really strange when you describe it to people. They think it's almost like a kind of voodoo when you describe it. And so you had that initial response to it also.
Yeah, a little hocus pocus.
Yeah.
I didn't go to grad school to wave my fingers in front of a client. So it was a little it was my first response.
Right.
But I was working with experiencing, as many of us do, just how prevalent trauma is. And clients will come in with a presenting issue, and then behind it is often a disturbing experience or a trauma. And I was working with somebody who had witnessed a violent act and was traumatized by that, and I was being supervised in an exposure therapy, a cognitive behavioral therapy, and using that approach. But the person was stuck with the trauma. They they were able to talk about it and say they hadn't done anything wrong, but they still felt guilty. They were able to say, well, I know this is logical, but I feel this way, and it doesn't make sense, and I can't let go of it, and I can't stop thinking about it. And they were, you know, having those intrusive images, like watching a videotape every night. I think this person described it. Well, I referred this person when he wasn't getting better. I referred this person to a psychologist trained in EMDR, and the client came back and said basically that the person did a lot of what I had done, but added eye movements and a couple other things, and it shifted. And this person didn't have the symptoms any longer. And I was blown away by that, of course, and thought, well, I really need to get this training. So I went for the training and found it very comprehensive, very informed. I went to a training with Francine Shapiro, the founder, who's quite bright, and learning about how she came upon EMDR. It was 1989, and she was working with Vietnam veterans. She herself was just dealing with something disturbing, and noticed that as she kind of worked through it, and it shifted the disturbing thing that she was working through, she noticed that her eyes were spontaneously moving right, back and forth. We call them saccadic eye movements, right, left. Mm-hmm. And she wondered, maybe thinking about the research that had been done on rapid eye movement, REM sleep, which plays a role in encoding memories. I don't know if she was also... There had been an interesting experiment in 1985 where people who suffered from something called hemi-neglect, or hemispheric neglect, with their individuals who had lesions on their right brain and the parietal lobes of their right brains, and they would actually deny the existence of the left side of their bodies. There was a classic case of a woman who would just put makeup on the right side of her face and not put it on the left side of her face. And in this experiment, I don't know how somebody kind of decided to do this, but they put cold water in the left ear canal. And what they found is that led to a series of rapid eye movements, and then a temporary cure, where the person then became aware of their left side and could see things on the left and give attention to their left. So there's already been research on eye movements. Mm-hmm. And so Francine Shapiro started to apply this to Vietnam vets, and she noticed they started to get better. She did a study and published it. And there were articles written. So I went to the training, and somebody knew I'd gone to the training, and they referred somebody to me right after that first training. I was kind of nervous about it. They referred somebody who suffered a horrible experience of their infant child dying of cancer. And this had happened 5 years before seeing me. I was a little overwhelmed by the idea of applying EMDR as newly trained to this. And, of course, the loss, the grief of this experience is normal, not something that EMDR is going to take away. But this person did have traumatic symptoms. This person was stuck with the image of the child dying. This person was not functioning, was repeatedly re-experiencing what had happened 5 years ago as though it had happened the day before.
It's like and a haunting. It's like being haunted.
Like being haunted, and like it's right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I utilized EMDR, and after a few sessions, this person was able to say, you know, the image of it is farther away. It feels like it happened 5 years ago, not yesterday. It's very disturbing when I bring it up, of course. How could it not be? But this person said they felt more in control of it and that they could start to grieve more normally now.
And so you really experienced firsthand through the beginning, your beginning work in this, how essentially your it's a treatment that doesn't it move memory from the reptilian brain, the amygdala, and kind of integrate it with other parts of the brain that are mediated by language and judgment and perception and context?
Yes, you know, Francine Shapiro says it's based on what she calls her an adaptive information processing system model, and that mm-hmm. we think one of the ways it works is it helps shift, make that shift of neural networks that are really stored and associated with the limbic system, with the amygdala, with that fight or flight state of mind, and linking that up with more adaptive neural mm-hmm. networks, logical thoughts, you know, person who feels responsible but when they're experiencing PTSD, but they know logically they're not, but they can't stop feeling like they are mm-hmm. responsible for their buddy in combat being killed.
Right.
But when that link up occurs, they can feel it now. It's like the thoughts that were there in a separate neural network in the frontal part of their brain is now communicating with the rest of the brain, with the limbic system, perhaps, in a way that sets, you know, it's like it's, the brain is now reset and no longer in that initial state of arousal.
I have seen the most amazing transformations with the use of EMDR. I think, people who have only marginally responded to talk therapy, traditional and different kinds of therapy, make the most transformative shifts through EMDR. And it seems almost miraculous. People who are so triggered daily, who either don't have any language around what's happening or don't feel like they have any coping skills, and they're in a heightened state of vigilance and upset, and how it seems to, I tell people you still have the memory, but it seems to dilute it and provide a narrative and calm all systems down in a way I've never seen anything else happen before. You apparently had that experience. That was your own beginning.
I was fortunate to have that early on, and then it encouraged me to continue and to really focus on this area, you know, and treating trauma. And of course, it's expanded to working with other problems, and whether it's general anxiety, social anxiety, eating disorders, because many of these problems originate with past disturbing experiences, whether a big T trauma or small T trauma, and early experiences where there's been neglect, really as a type of developmental trauma. And, we'll get into, I know you'll probably have some questions about that as well. But I was fortunate that way. And, of course, there are other therapies that, do the same. But I think EMDR is quicker. It's quicker than exposure therapy. Other therapies like sensory motor therapies, body-oriented therapies, energy therapies can lead to results. But I keep coming back to EMDR just as it just has been for me the work I've done, the most effective way of helping a person process trauma.
Yeah. And we've worked together, so I've really come to rely on you as a resource. You've been an amazing resource for, clients I've worked with. I'll be working with a couple and somebody's had an affair, or there's just a lot of past past trauma that seems to be intruding in an intense way into the relationship. And we'll get into this. And I've just seen
and
how...
And I've appreciated that, yeah. And
yeah,
that,
you know, just what a difference it really makes for them to have access to this work. Now, Phil, in the interest of time, could you say something about how would you define clinical hypnosis, because you use the two together, and a lot of people, you know, I don't know if that's a new thing, but it's not, that's not commonly done. What is clinical hypnosis, and why did you decide to incorporate that into your therapy work and your work with EMDR?
Sure, sure. First, I'll say what hypnosis is not. It's not being asleep or under the spell of a hypnotist, hypnotherapist. You know, and it's unfortunate that it all started with Mesmer and mesmerism. It is rather a state of focused, intentional focused attention in which there's what we call a fading of reality orientation that's kind of a not fully disconnecting from, but connected less to regular perception and sensation of what's going on around you. A person is still aware of where they are and what's going on around them under hypnosis, but there's a fading of that and an increased attending to particular thoughts or images under the guidance, suggestion of the therapist. And I use a style called permissive hypnotherapy that's very client-centered. It's not authoritarian. It's working with the client, finding that state of trance or focused attention. And there's different levels of that individuals have of hypnotizability. But Ericksonian hypnosis is a really very natural form of hypnosis where it's brought even into the language and the therapy sometimes where there isn't necessarily formal hypnotic inductions. I do what we call inductions where we use, you know, guided imagery so to deepen kind of that focused attention. But there's no falling asleep. You know, I can't guarantee a person won't fall asleep if I'm talking too much, but there's no fading away or losing. You know, I can't say to somebody, you're a monkey, stand on the chair and make monkey noises.
Right.
You know,
common
there's no loss of control. Exactly.
Yeah, common misconception that people are going to be made to do things they wouldn't want to do.
Right, right. But the benefit is with that focused attention is a person can then connect to subconscious resources that they might, innate resources that they might otherwise not be able to connect to as easily. Tapping into the wisdom and the strength of the subconscious. You know, we just think of the subconscious as a place where those strange dreams we have that we can't make sense of originate. But there's a great deal of wisdom and understanding that to be tapped into. And also the door to the subconscious mind being open, suggestions that are made or positive imagery that a person makes can kind of take root better and desired outcomes can become more automatic. So clinical hypnosis is used as a medium to enhance therapy rather mm-hmm. than being a therapy itself. So there's been research using it, showing it can enhance cognitive behavioral therapy, other therapy approaches. So it seemed natural to incorporate it in it's used a great deal with trauma work, but to incorporate it into EMDR, because what I found is that one of the strengths of hypnosis was it was helpful to access experience and information that a person couldn't talk about or wasn't even consciously aware mm-hmm. of. So a person, you sound like you're going to ask a question there.
Oh, no, no. I was thinking about retrieval, information kind of retrieval.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Helping to retrieve information. So, say a person comes in and they don't know why they're going numb after being intimate with someone that they are happy to be with, but that keeps happening. And it doesn't make any sense to them. Why they feel like a need to be distant, and it's tearing them up because it's they're becoming depressed because this keeps happening. And then under hypnosis, we're exploring what happens, and we find out there isn't really anything recently that's contributing to it. But under hypnosis, the person's able to go back to the past experience. Sometimes that happens in EMDR too, where past experiences will come up. But but that's a strength with hypnosis, is accessing these experiences. And a person may go back to a sexual abuse experience that happened when they were a child or an adolescent that was blocked out of awareness. And then what I've found I could do is right once that the person is in trance, and I'll move right into EMDR. As long as I've already introduced the EMDR to them and they know what I'm doing, you know, and with their permission. With EMDR, when you're processing, part of why EMDR also works is there's a dual attention, a dual awareness of past and present, and you know, focusing on images, on the images, on sensations in the body, negative thoughts, what you'd prefer to be thinking, and then what we call bilateral stimulation. That could be eye movements, that could be tapping. I use something called a TheraTapper, which vibrates in each hand back and forth. And so it's both the right left stimulation, stimulating those brain mechanisms, but also the dual attention, okay, being present as well as 1 foot in the past, 1 foot in the present. And the person can kind of stay in what we'd call an optimal zone of arousal. So they don't become overwhelmed, and they can process the experience. And hypnosis helps to access experiences. It also helps finding resources and tools to regulate emotion, to cope, to make, in fact, EMDR already incorporates imagery work. And that originated in the clinical hypnosis field without even calling it hypnosis. So there was already a sense in which they were working together, but I just took it a little further. It was something that Francine Shapiro was not really, I guess she was recommending against it, but I had some cases, I wrote an article on why I thought they could work together, and yeah, hypnosis helps to access information. That's one of the strengths, and then EMDR helps to process the experience.
Now,
so the two together work.
Yeah. Now, Phil, is it? Now, I know you wrote a pretty well-known paper on the subject about the use of both. Is it kind of new in the field to combine clinical hypnosis with EMDR? Are you sort of an anomaly in doing that, or what?
Well, it had been done, but more, I think, not so much combined simultaneously, more alternatingly. And there had been an article on EMDR and clinical hypnosis published before by a well-known Ericksonian hypnotherapist, Stephen Gilligan. There has been some articles, especially in application with dissociation and dissociative disorders, but still not. But they didn't really emphasize doing trance work and doing the EMDR within the trance work. And I found, you know, I think there was a fear that there would be less of that dual attention. But my training in hypnosis indicated that wasn't the case. That that a person could be aware of past and present while in hypnotic trance. And so in particular cases where it was appropriate, I applied it that way, and there were positive outcomes.
Oh,
so
that's
that was
great.
Maybe what was different in my paper, I guess.
Okay, so you're a bit of a pioneer in combining them in the way that you do. I think it's terrific.
At least writing about it. At least writing about it anyway, I guess.
Well, and we'll see how it bears out in terms of outcomes. Now, if I were a client getting this treatment, the EMDR and the clinical hypnosis, what could I expect it to look like in a typical session? You mentioned tapping. Could you create a picture for our listeners what they could expect a session to actually look like?
Yeah, well, let's start with convention with standard EMDR.
Okay.
A person, you know, that has a trauma, say an auto accident, they're invited to, of course, they get the history and make sure that they're appropriate to move. It's appropriate to move into EMDR, and it's just like any therapy session in that regard. But as we move to EMDR, what it actually, the processing part of EMDR, what that would look like is the person is asked to come up with a picture that represents maybe the worst of what happened or something that's very troubling or that they're stuck with,
an image.
Kind of picture. I suppose they could draw a picture too, but yeah, an image. And then we kind of rate how disturbing it is using a scale called a subjective unit of disturbance scale. We have them identify sensations in the body that go along with that picture, the negative thoughts, the negative beliefs about themselves now. As they think about what happened in the past, thoughts that, you know, ways that they're stuck. Sometimes they're usually about safety or I'm not safe or I'm responsible in some way or, identifying how they're continuing to think about it that represents the being haunted. And then, of course, the emotions they're experiencing and finding what they'd prefer to be able to think so that if there was more of that integration and they were able to engage their frontal cortex, what would be the rational thought that they can't seem to really believe subjectively now, but they want to, and kind of help them identify what that is. I am safe. I am able to do things to be safe, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ask them to hold these things together, and then we do a set of eye movements or bilateral stimulation, you know, the tapping right, left, theratapper in each hand, right, left. We do that for a set of a certain number, and stop and then ask what comes up. And whatever, this is where it's very client-centered. You're kind of getting out of the way of the process. We'll just ask them, and it's a mindful process. We ask them to observe without judging and just, so something comes up, we say, okay, go with that. Notice and go with that. Do another set. And then I'll see a different, the affect has changed in the person. I'll ask, what's coming up? Oh, yeah, the image is changing in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe first it's harder. I'm connecting with it more, but they're willing to go with it, and we continue. And then okay, now it feels like it's not as strong, the feeling.
So they're experiencing it, but they're observing it at the same time.
That's right.
Yeah. And it sounds like you pull in, what is it, the whole prefrontal cortex part of the brain, to give it narrative and context and all of that. So you're basically pulling it out of their reptilian brain and into, pulling in other parts of their brain to help them observe it and be with it in a different way, it sounds like.
Yeah, the mammalian brain and the reptilian brain, the limbic system, is just, it's like it's there's a lack of integration between those, what we call those subcortical areas in the brain, and the frontal part, the frontal cortex.
Yeah.
So they might have done therapy work and have all the idea, you know, have all the rational thoughts
yes.
there, right? But they can't feel, it doesn't apply. It's like they can identify it and they know it's rational, but it doesn't seem real. Doesn't seem
yeah.
like, and then we see the signs that that integration is occurring because it shifts. Now, what mm-hmm. was not valid, the negative thought, you know, we then tried to find a positive alternative thought, and that positive alternative, we're looking for the validity of that positive thought to increase. And that's what we see happening. It's like, yeah, I believe this now. I believe mm-hmm. that I'm not responsible, that this other person was responsible, or
mm-hmm.
that I can be safe. And that's a sign that, yeah, that link-up is happening, that processing.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many sessions, Phil, would you say a person would need for what would be a typical round of treatment for this? And, I'm wondering about the logistics of this. If somebody's interested in pursuing it, whether insurance covers it, and how many sessions they could expect to spend doing EMDR if they wanted to resolve, an issue in this way?
Yeah, well, and it depends on the nature of the issue, the client, the kind of trauma. Was it a trauma from childhood, which is going to take more time to work through in as a phase-oriented process of trauma treatment, or was it a single experience in adulthood?
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who had an auto accident. I've had some clients see resolution of their trauma in as quickly as 3 sessions. Was probably the quickest to, although it was really in one session of processing that the shift took place, but 3 sessions that they needed to do the whole process was the shortest to, 8 sessions, 12 sessions, a really brief therapy for trauma, And then there's others where, okay, it's tapping into some other stuff. It's a little more complicated. They need to go 20 sessions, maybe a little longer, because it also brings up some other previous experiences or complications, or they've been coping with a traumatic experience for a while, and that way of coping has become a
right.
current behavioral problem that needs to be addressed, and we can
yeah.
utilize hypnosis and EMDR for that. Childhood trauma that then, that can affect a person's attachment style and interpersonal relationships. And that's going to take longer, and it's going to take the first phase, if they haven't already done this kind of work, safety, stabilization, developing skills for regulating emotions, for feeling grounded, doing more work in that area. With attachment, as a couples therapist, there's secure attachment that comes out of secure parenting experiences and those normal needs for attachment being met when we're children. And the critical times in development that then get internalized, and a person has a secure, what we call internal working model of attachment and how they relate to others versus an insecure attachment, and that can be experienced or expressed as a couple different ways. One is an avoidant attachment style, where a person, doesn't engage, kind of is more dismissive in adulthood because that's how they coped as when they were children, or they're anxious and preoccupied and very fearful of abandonment, and that was their experience, as a child.
Yeah, and you know something I see in my work, we're kind of into, I'm glad you mentioned this because we're into the next issue, how trauma plays out in close relationships and how EMDR and hypnosis can change that. But, you know, obviously it affects people's, it sets the stage for certain attachment styles. And what I see so routinely in my work is somebody with a dismissive attachment style where they're distancing and kind of held back and defensive with a partner who's anxious and preoccupied and who's very kind of hypervigilant about, are we connecting enough? Do you love me enough? Why aren't you here? And it's really difficult to work with because what you have in the room are, you know, you have very old scripts and old narratives playing out. And and it's, I think this is where this is a wonderful use of EMDR and clinical hypnosis, where you can, instead of, you know, just focusing on the present and how that plays out, look at the context for it, how the stage was set by very early experiences. And my experience as a couples therapist is that you're really limited in terms of traditional talk therapy. I mean, people can have all kinds of insight in the world, but I think people really need to kind of get to a deeper level to really rework these things. So it's such an important tool, I think.
And that's where that emotionally focused approach in couples work and is, you know, locally, incidentally, we have in Portsmouth psychologist Mark Moses, who also does EMDR and family therapy and couples work, and he's also published in an article in EMDR with couples, and he finds that doing some of that work conjointly or, you know, with both partners, it can be powerful because the other partner, and I'm sure you see this just in the emotional work you do with couples, but the other partner witnessing the experience of their partner working through something enhances emotional connectivity and empathy.
Oh, yeah.
And has had so he's shared some or written up some very powerful cases where that's happened. So that's another resource in the area here. But with, you know, and with shifting to clinical hypnosis, my mentor for where I received most of my clinical hypnosis training is Daniel Brown, psychologist in Boston and Newton, Massachusetts. Brilliant.
He's a hot show. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he certainly is. And he's developed, or he's expanded upon work that was done by some others and made it take it in a different direction, where he does attachment repair imagery, connecting with, you know, we're talking about neural networks. So, everybody has parts of themselves from past experiences that are really kind of neural networks around past experiences. So we can kind of connect to, like if you've heard of internal family systems, if listeners have a child part, and then maybe visualize positive experiences of getting needs met. And the initial response many people have, well, I didn't have any models for healthy parenting. How could I possibly do that? But he's been able to work, and I've applied it in a similar way, to individuals who had very traumatic childhood experiences, a great deal of neglect, dissociation, and found that, you know, with time, there's an instinctive, normal sense. It's kind of like we're born with that normal, instinctive need for attachment, and we can connect to that and visualize that. So he'll have somebody picture somebody that is a healthy attachment figure and tuned in and consistent and genuine. And some people will even just think of a media figure, you know, mm-hmm. Oprah. Or,
yes, like a surrogate. Like
yeah,
a
surrogate parent, exactly.
Yeah,
using
yeah.
the imagery, and then you know, and of course, hypnotic work can deepen that. And I've had men that I wouldn't imagine be able to do that, you know, sitting in the chair in my office in trance, doing that imagery with a smile on their face, just and connecting to feelings that they hadn't connected to, of being valued,
mm-hmm.
and then reporting that it made a difference.
Yeah.
In their interactions with others. So, and then EMDR is, of course, applied to past experiences,
right.
You know, and working, you know, we're letting go of blame and shame.
Right.
And
so there's a lot going on. It really, there's really a lot going on in the field that is kind of pioneering and opening up whole new frontiers for
a great
people.
Deal.
And,
hard to
oh
keep
yeah,
up
making
with
a difference.
Now,
my
so
experience,
much, yeah.
yeah, with the EMDR is that what I tell clients and my experience with it so far is that insurance likes to cover it because it's a measurable, it's a relatively short-term treatment, and it's got measurable results. And insurance loves something that they can kind of quantify and measure.
Yes, it used to be that you wouldn't put EMDR in your treatment plan for insurance companies, but now you can, and they like it. And
yeah.
clinical hypnosis, you know, it's a it's not a therapy itself. It's a medium in which
right.
you're doing therapy. So insurance pays for the therapy, and you're just incorporating
yeah.
Hypnosis into it. Insurance won't pay for, you know, strictly hypnosis for smoking cessation unless you have a special plan, for instance. But
mm-hmm.
But as a part of psychotherapy, that's also that insurance will pay for that.
Yeah. Now, we have a few people on the line, but nobody's asking a question. So if anybody has a question, I think this might be a good time to press the one on your phone. And feel free to ask Phil anything you want to know about this issue. It's a very compelling issue. What I would say is that if not at this moment you have a question, if it comes up before we stop, I'll just put you on the air. Nobody's asking, so why don't we continue? Phil, in the interest of time, we have about 10 minutes left. I'm wondering if someone has a partner or a spouse who's undergoing EMDR, what could they do to support the treatment?
You know, I think it might be helpful for the therapist to bring them in and so there can be some education around what the person is experiencing, the nature of trauma, why they respond to particular types of triggers.
To inform them.
Them.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. And to encourage them, you know, if there are problems like the person's reacting emotionally, and they find themselves in these, you know, repeatedly in these patterns of reacting to each other emotionally, and to then come back and with that understanding, with that information they have. Recognizing, okay, this was a trigger, and come together and observe what happened. You know, in general, I think that's useful for trauma. And with EMDR, to recognize that when they're doing EMDR, they may get a little worse before they get better.
Mm-hmm.
They may just need a little extra support while they're processing something. To stay hopeful.
Okay, and to recognize that it's a process. I think what
you
said about recognizing the triggers is really important. I've worked with a number of couples where one person is undergoing EMDR, they've experienced trauma, and they're a work in process. And I think it's generally very helpful in my experience with couples to have the person who's undergoing the EMDR kind of educate the other person about what they know about their triggers, what circumstances are particularly hairy for them, and what they're working on, what kind of skills, just to give them a little bit of a heads up about what kind of skills they're working on to try to manage these triggers so that the support partner doesn't unwittingly step on the other one's minefield. That's a kind of metaphor that I often use, that it's important to kind of learn each other's minefields. And the person who's been through trauma has pretty significant ones. And if you can kind of get a lay of the land and learn what the mines are, then you can walk more gingerly around them. And to see that, really see that as a conversation between the two, as a kind of ongoing thing.
Yes. And, you know, you mentioned that we will share some of our clients, and I've appreciated being able to see a client after having a couple session with you, and then the client being able to identify, you know, talk about what was identified in the session as a particular kind of pattern or avoidance or being triggered a certain way. And then in our session, whether drawing from EMDR or hypnosis, working on, you know, changing that behavior or diffusing it or processing what's behind the trigger, and it works nicely, you know, to have the work together. And I think for the individual therapist, there's doing talk therapy and getting some insight and making observations, and then doing some EMDR or hypnosis and kind of going back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so with couples and relationships, there's the problems are opportunities. It's all grist for the mill, right? It's recognizing what are triggers, and even if with the best intention, they try to avoid that minefield, as you say, but they don't inadvertently, it happens, then come back together, right, and look at it together mindfully, because that's an opportunity, and to say, here we are again, and when I did this, you responded this way, and that was a trigger and tapped into this, and then hopefully that's increasing understanding and empathy.
I think the supportive partner understand that the trauma victim is not in logic land, because often I found that the other partner will say, why do you keep doing that? We've talked about that. We've been working on that. I would think by now you would stop shutting down, or you would stop screaming and just having these fits. And, you know, I think a lot of the work is really helping the outside partner understand that this is kind of outside the realm of logic. And the process tries to bring it into a more, I don't know if logical is the right word, but a more rational, rational.
Observing.
Kind of,
then hopefully that partner doesn't then, you know, it's natural for the partner to then be reactive, right? But hopefully that helps the partner not to take it personally and react the same way. And that's all part of, you know, hopefully contributing to changing the pattern, which,
I think that's really important. Now, Phil, is there any introductory reading material that you would recommend? And, you know, I don't know how many people on the line are lay public versus practitioners, but any real introductory reading material that you'd recommend, or should people just go to your website, which, by the way, I hung out in your website. I had more fun in your website because what our listeners should know, it's SeacoastPsychotherapy.com. You have all kinds of tests on that site. You could take the Myers-Briggs thing. You could find out about your attachment style. It's a wealth of information and self-tests and all kinds of stuff. So
yeah, I had fun one day finding these links. So I put them on there for my clients. And anybody's welcome to go on there and follow the links. Absolutely. and there's reading there about EMDR, links to EMDR and clinical hypnosis as well. For the layperson, a good introduction to EMDR is written by Francine Shapiro, called EMDR, the Breakthrough Therapy, and that's just written for the layperson. And then a book on clinical hypnosis for the layperson, or a couple. One is The Inner Source, Exploring Hypnosis, or The Inner Source, and that's written by Donald Connery, C-O-N-N-E-R-Y, like Sean Connery. And also Hypnosis for the Seriously Curious is an older title that might be out of print, but you know, so you might be able to still find that. I can't recall the author's name of that one.
And what's the name of the first hypnosis book again?
The Inner Source.
Oh, The Inner
Exploring,
Source. By
Exploring Hypnosis. Connery.
Okay.
The Inner Source. And then I, for people who are interested in the neuroscience, you know, it's for both the layperson and the therapist, and this writer also incorporates, does the EMDR work. It's Louis Cozzolino. He's become a bestseller, and he's written a book called Neuroscience of Human Relationships, which is really interesting. Louis Cozzolino.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also like to recommend for the Margaret Werenberg, Werenberg, and she's a therapist that draws neuroscience into her approaches, and a couple self-help books, 10 Best Anxiety Techniques, and then there's 10 Best Depression Techniques.
Okay. Now, do you have any of these books listed on the website? I got so caught up in taking the self-tests, I didn't notice that these books were there.
No, but maybe I can, since I've done this show and mentioned them, maybe I'll do a little recommended reading section, add it to my website and include these books on there. So if anybody was trying to write something down and didn't get it, come back in a few days to the website and can find it there.
Yeah. Well, Phil, believe it or not, we're almost at the end of the show. I can't believe it. This went like lightning.
Fun.
Yeah, I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and thanks to all you listeners and callers. And anybody who wants to reach Phil, his name is Phil Harford, and it's seacoastpsychotherapy.com. You want me to give out your office number again?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, it's on the page. It's 603-766-0137, and you can reach Phil there. He's really a kind of treasure as a resource, and really fun to work with, and very respectful, and just very tender and caring and informed and just all good things. And that's another thing, by the way, any therapist who might be listening to this, it's important to work with somebody when, you know, EMDR is, it's often, and it's a kind of auxiliary treatment. Somebody's primarily in individual therapy or couples. And it's very important to work with somebody who knows how to do, you know, another piece, and how to participate and how to treat it kind of like a symphony where you're all playing different parts. And you do that really beautifully, Phil. So
thank you, Susan. It's been it's a pleasure working with you and sharing clients. And congratulations on this radio program taking off.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Matt, you have here.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. And for you listeners, tune into my next episode, which is Wednesday, February 22nd at 8:30 p.m., and it's going to be about dealing with major loss, featuring my guest, Ashley Davis Bush. This one will also, I'm sure, incorporate a fair amount of trauma. She's the best-selling author of Transcending Loss and Shortcuts to Inner Peace. So, you know, I'm going to be hanging out with her. So, again, thank you, Phil, and you know, maybe we can do this again sometime and to another level.
Thank you, Susan.
Okay.
Have a good evening.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye-bye.